This is Audible.
Blackstone Audio presents Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee, An Indian History of the American West by D. Brown. Dedication for Nicholas Brave Wolf.
Preface. An ancient tradition tells us that the interval between the birth of the parents and the arrival of their first offspring averages 30 years. We call that a generation. 30 years ago, early in 1971, this book was born, and so now it is beginning its second generation. As the first generation ends, it is almost a cliché to say that enormous changes have occurred during the time that has passed. Yet vast changes certainly have affected the present-day descendants of the old tribal prophets whose stories are told in these pages. During the past generation, some tribal reservations have prospered, others have not. There are now, and probably always will be, disagreements within tribes as to the direction their people should take. In spite of the many personal frustrations and difficulties young seekers of knowledge experience, it is no longer unusual to meet American Indian lawyers, physicians, college professors, computer specialists, artists, writers, or members of almost any other profession or trade. Yet on some reservations there is still a shortage of proper places in which to live, and the county with the deepest poverty in the United States is still a tribal reservation. Judging from letters I have received through the years, the readers who have given life to this book come from almost all the 100 or so ethnic groups that comprise this unique and awesome place called America. Small though the comparative number of American Indians is, almost all other Americans seem to have an earnest fascination for their history, their arts and literature, their attitude toward the natural world, and their philosophy of human existence. And this wide interest exists beyond the borders of America into the lands of other people and other cultures. Name a small nation, one whose people have a history of past injustices and oppression, and this book will likely be in print there. We rarely know the full power of words, in print or spoken. It is my hope that time has not dulled the words herein, and that they will continue through the coming generation to be as true and direct as I originally meant them to be. D. Brown, in the year 2000. Introduction. Since the exploratory journey of Lewis and Clark to the Pacific Coast early in the 19th century, the number of published accounts describing the opening of the American West has risen into the thousands. The greatest concentration of recorded experience and observation came out of the 30-year span between 1860 and 1890, the period covered by this book. It was an incredible era of violence, greed, audacity, sentimentality, undirected exuberance, and an almost reverential attitude toward the ideal of personal freedom for those who already had it. During that time, the culture and civilization of the American Indian was destroyed. And out of that time came virtually all the great myths of the American West. Tales of fur traders, mountain men, steamboat pilots, gold seekers, gamblers, gunmen, cavalrymen, cowboys, harlots, missionaries, schoolmarms, and homesteaders. Only occasionally was the voice of an Indian heard, and then, more often than not, it was recorded by the pen of a white man. The Indian was the dark menace of the myths, and even if he had known how to write in English, where would he have found a printer or a publisher? Yet they are not all lost, those Indian voices of the past. A few authentic accounts of American Western history were recorded by Indians, either in pictographs or in translated English, and some managed to get published in obscure journals, pamphlets, or books of small circulation. In the late 19th century, when the white man's curiosity about Indian survivors of the wars reached a high point, enterprising newspaper reporters frequently interviewed warriors and chiefs and gave them an opportunity to express their opinions on what was happening in the West. The quality of these interviews varied greatly, depending upon the abilities of the interpreters or upon the inclination of the Indians to speak freely. Some feared reprisals for telling the truth, while others delighted in hoaxing reporters with tall tales and shaggy dog stories. Contemporary newspaper statements by Indians must therefore be read with skepticism, although some of them are masterpieces of irony, and others burn with outbursts of poetic fury. Among the richest sources of first-person statements by Indians are the records of treaty councils and other formal meetings with civilian and military representatives of the United States government. Isaac Pitman's new stenographic system was coming into vogue during the second half of the 19th century, and when Indians spoke in council, a recording clerk sat beside the official interpreter. Even when the meetings were in remote parts of the West, someone usually was available to write down the speeches. And because of the slowness of the translation process, much of what was said could be recorded in longhand. Interpreters quite often were half-bloods who knew spoken languages, but seldom could read or write. Like most oral peoples, they and the Indians depended upon imagery to express their thoughts, so that the English translations were filled with graphic similes and metaphors of the natural world. If an eloquent Indian had a poor interpreter, his words might be transformed to flat prose, but a good interpreter could make a poor speaker sound poetic. Most Indian leaders spoke freely and candidly in councils with white officials, and as they became more sophisticated in such matters during the 1870s and 1880s, they demanded the right to choose their own interpreters and recorders. In this latter period, all members of the tribes were free to speak, and some of the older men chose such opportunities to recount events they had witnessed in the past, or to sum up the histories of their peoples. Although the Indians who lived through this doom period of their civilization have vanished from the earth, millions of their words are preserved in official records. Many of the more important council proceedings were published in government documents and reports. Out of all these sources of almost forgotten oral history, I have tried to fashion a narrative of the conquest of the American West as the victims experienced it, using their own words whenever possible. Americans who have always looked westward when reading about this period should read this book facing eastward. This is not a cheerful book, but history has a way of intruding upon the present, and perhaps those who read it will have a clearer understanding of what the American Indian is by knowing what he was. They may be surprised to hear words of gentle reasonableness coming from the mouths of Indians stereotyped in the American myth as ruthless savages. They may learn something about their own relationship to the earth from a people who were true conservationists. The Indians knew that life was equated with the earth and its resources, that America was a paradise, and they could not comprehend why the intruders from the East were determined to destroy all that was Indian, as well as America itself. And if the readers of this book should ever chance to see the poverty, the hopelessness, and the squalor of a modern Indian reservation, they may find it possible to truly understand the reasons why. D. Brown, Urbana, Illinois, April 1970. I shall not be there. I shall rise and pass. Bury my heart at wounded knee. Stephen Vincent Benet. Chapter 1. Their manners are decorous and praiseworthy. Where today are the Pequot? Where are the Narragansett, the Mohican, the Poconoket, and many other once powerful tribes of our people? They have vanished before the avarice and the oppression of the white man, as snow before a summer sun. Will we let ourselves be destroyed in our turn without a struggle, give up our homes, our country bequeathed to us by the Great Spirit, the graves of our dead, and everything that is dear and sacred to us? I know you will cry with me, never, never. Tecumseh of the Shawnees. It began with Christopher Columbus, who gave the people the name Indios. Those Europeans, the white men, spoke in different dialects, and some pronounced the word Indien, or Indianer, or Indian. Peau Rouge, or Redskins, came later. As was the custom of the people when receiving strangers, the Tainos on the island of San Salvador generously presented Columbus and his men with gifts and treated them with honor. "So tractable, so peaceable are these people," Columbus wrote to the King and Queen of Spain, "that I swear to your majesties there is not in the world a better nation. They love their neighbors as themselves, and their discourse is ever sweet and gentle and accompanied with a smile. And though it is true that they are naked, yet their manners are decorous and praiseworthy." All this, of course, was taken as a sign of weakness, if not heathenism, and Columbus, being a righteous European, was convinced the people should be made to work, sow and do all that is necessary, and to adopt our ways. Over the next four centuries, 1492 to 1890, several million Europeans and their descendants undertook to enforce their ways upon the people of the New World. Columbus kidnapped 10 of his friendly Taino hosts and carried them off to Spain, where they could be introduced to the white man's ways. One of them died soon after arriving there, but not before he was baptized a Christian. The Spaniards were so pleased that they had made it possible for the first Indian to enter heaven that they hastened to spread the good news throughout the West Indies. The Tainos and other Arawak people did not resist conversion to the Europeans' religion, but they did resist strongly when hordes of these bearded strangers began scouring their islands in search of gold and precious stones. The Spaniards looted and burned villages. They kidnapped hundreds of men, women, and children and shipped them to Europe to be sold as slaves. Arawak resistance brought on the use of guns and sabers, and whole tribes were destroyed, hundreds of thousands of people in less than a decade after Columbus set foot on the beach of San Salvador, October 12, 1492. Communications between the tribes of the New World were slow, and news of the Europeans' barbarities rarely overtook the rapid spread of new conquests and settlements. Long before the English-speaking white men arrived in Virginia in 1607, however, the Powhatans had heard rumors about the civilizing techniques of the Spaniards. The Englishmen used subtler methods. To ensure peace long enough to establish a settlement at Jamestown, they put a golden crown upon the head of Wahansonacook, dubbed him King Powhatan, and convinced him that he should put his people to work supplying the white settlers with food. Wahansonacook vacillated between loyalty to his rebellious subjects and to the English, but after John Rolfe married his daughter, Pocahontas, he apparently decided that he was more English than Indian. After Wahansonacook died, the Powhatans rose up in revenge to drive the Englishmen back into the sea from which they had come, but the Indians underestimated the power of English weapons. In a short time, the 8,000 Powhatans were reduced to less than 1,000. In Massachusetts, the story began somewhat differently, but ended virtually the same as in Virginia. After the Englishmen landed at Plymouth in 1620, most of them probably would have starved to death but for aid received from friendly natives of the New World. A Pemaquid named Samoset and three Wampanoags named Massasoit, Squanto, and Hoboma became self-appointed missionaries to the Pilgrims. All spoke some English, learned from explorers who had touched ashore in previous years. Squanto had been kidnapped by an English seaman who sold him into slavery in Spain, but he escaped through the aid of another Englishman and finally managed to return home. He and the other Indians regarded the Plymouth colonists as helpless children. They shared corn with them from the tribal stores, showed them where and how to catch fish, and got them through the first winter. When spring came, they gave the white men some seed corn and showed them how to plant and cultivate it. For several years, these Englishmen and their Indian neighbors lived in peace, but many more shiploads of white people continued coming ashore. The ring of axes and the crash of falling trees echoed up and down the coasts of the land which the white men now called New England. Settlements began crowding in upon each other. In 1625, some of the colonists asked Samoset to give them 12,000 additional acres of Pemaquid land. Samoset knew that land came from the Great Spirit, was as endless as the sky, and belonged to no man. To humor these strangers in their strange ways, however, he went through a ceremony of transferring the land and made his mark on a paper for them. It was the first deed of Indian land to English colonists. Most of the other settlers, coming in by thousands now, did not bother to go through such a ceremony. By the time Massasoit, great chief of the Wampanoags, died in 1662, his people were being pushed back into the wilderness. His son Metacom foresaw doom for all Indians unless they united to resist the invaders. Although the New Englanders flattered Metacom by crowning him King Philip of Poconoket, he devoted most of his time to forming alliances with the Narragansetts and other tribes in the region. In 1675, after a series of arrogant actions by the colonists, King Philip led his Indian Confederacy into a war meant to save the tribes from extinction. The Indians attacked 52 settlements, completely destroying 12 of them, But after months of fighting, the firepower of the colonists virtually exterminated the Wampanoags and the Narragansetts. King Philip was killed and his head publicly exhibited at Plymouth for 20 years. Along with other captured Indian women and children, his wife and young son were sold into slavery in the West Indies. When the Dutch came to Manhattan Island, Peter Minuit purchased it for 60 guilders in fish hooks and glass beads, but encouraged the Indians to remain and continue exchanging their valuable peltries for such trinkets. In 1641, William Kieft levied tribute upon the Mohicans and sent soldiers to Staten Island to punish the Raritans for offenses which had been committed not by them but by white settlers. The Raritans resisted arrest and the soldiers killed 4 of them. When the Indians retaliated by killing 4 Dutchmen, Kieft ordered the massacre of 2 entire villages while the inhabitants slept. The Dutch soldiers ran their bayonets through men, women, and children, hacked their bodies to pieces, and then leveled the villages with fire. For 2 more centuries, these events were repeated again and again as the European colonists moved inland through the passes of the Alleghenies and down the westward flowing rivers to the Great Waters, the Mississippi, and then up the Great Muddy, the Missouri. The 5 nations of the Iroquois, mightiest and most advanced of all the eastern tribes, strove in vain for peace. After years of bloodshed to save their political independence, they finally went down to defeat. Some escaped to Canada, some fled westward, some lived out their lives in reservation confinement. During the 1760s, Pontiac of the Ottawas united tribes in the Great Lakes country in hopes of driving the British back across the Alleghenies, but he failed. His major error was an alliance with French-speaking white men who withdrew aid from the Peau Rouge during the crucial siege of Detroit. A generation later, Tecumseh of the Shawnees formed a great confederacy of Midwestern and Southern tribes to protect their lands from invasion. The dream ended with Tecumseh's death in battle during the War of 1812. Between 1795 and 1840, the Miamis fought battle after battle and signed treaty after treaty, ceding their rich Ohio Valley lands until there was none left to cede. When white settlers began streaming into the Illinois country after the War of 1812, the Sauks and Foxes fled across the Mississippi. A subordinate chief, Black Hawk, refused to retreat. He created an alliance with the Winnebagoes, Potawatomis, and Kickapoos and declared war against the new settlements. A band of Winnebagoes, who accepted a white soldier chief's bribe of 20 horses and $100, betrayed Black Hawk, and he was captured in 1832. He was taken east for imprisonment and display to the curious. After he died in 1838, the governor of the recently created Iowa Territory obtained Black Hawk's skeleton and kept it on view in his office. In 1829, Andrew Jackson, who was called Sharp Knife by the Indians, took office as President of the United States. During his frontier career, Sharp Knife and his soldiers had slain thousands of Cherokees, Chickasaws, Choctaws, Creeks, and Seminoles, but these southern Indians were still numerous and clung stubbornly to their tribal lands, which had been assigned them forever by white men's treaties. In Sharp Knife's first message to his Congress, he recommended that all these Indians be removed westward beyond the Mississippi. "I suggest the propriety of setting apart an ample district west of the Mississippi to be guaranteed to the Indian tribes as long as they shall occupy it." Although enactment of such a law would only add to the long list of broken promises made to the eastern Indians, Sharp Knife was convinced that Indians and whites could not live together in peace, and that his plan would make possible a final promise which never would be broken again. On May 28, 1830, Sharp Knife's recommendations became law. 2 years later, he appointed a commissioner of Indian affairs to serve in the War Department and see that the new laws affecting Indians were properly carried out. And then on June 30, 1834, Congress passed an act to regulate trade and intercourse with the Indian tribes and to preserve peace on the frontiers. All that part of the United States west of the Mississippi, and not within the states of Missouri and Louisiana or the territory of Arkansas, would be Indian country. No white persons would be permitted to trade in the Indian country without a license. No white traders of bad character would be permitted to reside in Indian country. No white persons would be permitted to settle in the Indian country. The military force of the United States would be employed in the apprehension of any white person who was found in violation of provisions of the Act. Before these laws could be put into effect, a new wave of white settlers swept westward and formed the territories of Wisconsin and Iowa. This made it necessary for the policymakers in Washington to shift the permanent Indian frontier from the Mississippi River to the 95th Meridian. This line ran from Lake of the Woods on what is now the Minnesota-Canada border, slicing southward through what are now the states of Minnesota and Iowa, and then along the western borders of Missouri, Arkansas, and Louisiana to Galveston Bay, Texas. To keep the Indians beyond the 95th Meridian, and to prevent unauthorized white men from crossing it, soldiers were garrisoned in a series of military posts that ran southward from Fort Snelling on the Mississippi River to Forts Atkinson and Leavenworth on the Missouri, Forts Gibson and Smith on the Arkansas, Fort Towson on the Red, and Fort Jessup in Louisiana. More than three centuries have now passed since Christopher Columbus landed on San Salvador, more than two centuries since the English colonists came to Virginia and New England. In that time, the friendly Tainos who welcomed Columbus ashore had been utterly obliterated. Long before the last of the Tainos died, their simple agricultural and handicraft culture was destroyed and replaced by cotton plantations worked by slaves. The white colonists chopped down the tropical forests to enlarge their fields. The cotton plants exhausted the soil. Winds unbroken by a forest shield covered the fields with sand. When Columbus first saw the island, he described it as very big and very level, and the trees very green, the whole of it so green that it is a pleasure to gaze upon. The Europeans who followed him there destroyed its vegetation and its inhabitants, human, animal, bird, and fish, and after turning it into a wasteland, they abandoned it. On the mainland of America, the Wampanoags of Massasoit and King Philip had vanished, along with the Chesapeakes, the Chickahominies, and the Potomacs of the great Powhatan Confederacy. Only Pocahontas was remembered. Scattered or reduced to remnants were the Pequots, Montauks, Nanticokes, Machapungas, Catawbas, Chiraws, Miamis, Hurons, Eries, Mohawks, Senecas, and Mohegans. Only Uncas was remembered. Their musical names remained forever fixed on the American land, but their bones were forgotten in a thousand burned villages or lost in forests fast disappearing before the axes of 20 million invaders. Already the once sweet-watered streams, most of which bore Indian names, were clouded with silt and the wastes of man. The very earth was being ravaged and squandered. To the Indians it seemed that these Europeans hated everything in nature, the living forests and their birds and beasts, the grassy glades, the water, the soil, and the air itself. The decade following establishment of the permanent Indian frontier was a bad time for the eastern tribes. The great Cherokee nation had survived more than 100 years of the white man's wars, diseases, and whiskey, but now it was to be blotted out. Because the Cherokees numbered several thousands, their removal to the west was planned to be in gradual stages, but discovery of Appalachian gold within their territory brought on a clamor for their immediate wholesale exodus. During the autumn of 1838, General Winfield Scott's soldiers rounded them up and concentrated them into camps. A few hundred escaped to the Smoky Mountains, and many years later were given a small reservation in North Carolina. From the prison camps, they were started westward to Indian territory. On the long winter trek, one of every four Cherokees died from cold, hunger, or disease. They called the march their Trail of Tears. The Choctaws, Chickasaws, Creeks, and Seminoles also gave up their homelands in the south. In the north, surviving remnants of the Shawnees, Miamis, Ottawas, Hurons, Delawares, and many other once mighty tribes walked or traveled by horseback and wagon beyond the Mississippi, carrying their shabby goods, their rusty farming tools, and bags of seed corn. All of them arrived as refugees, poor relations, in the country of the proud and free Plains Indians. Scarcely were the refugees settled behind the security of the permanent Indian frontier when soldiers began marching westward through the Indian country. The white men of the United States, who talked so much of peace but rarely seemed to practice it, were marching to war with the white men who had conquered the Indians of Mexico. When the war with Mexico ended in 1847, the United States took possession of a vast expanse of territory reaching from Texas to California. All of it was west of the permanent Indian frontier. In 1848, gold was discovered in California. Within a few months, fortune-seeking Easterners by the thousands were crossing the Indian Territory. Indians who lived or hunted along the Santa Fe and Oregon trails had grown accustomed to seeing an occasional wagon train licensed for traders, trappers, or missionaries. Now, suddenly, the trails were filled with wagons, and the wagons were filled with white people. Most of them were bound for California gold, but some turned southwest for New Mexico or northwest for the Oregon country. To justify these breaches of the permanent Indian frontier, the policymakers in Washington invented manifest destiny, a term which lifted land hunger to a lofty plane. The Europeans and their descendants were ordained by destiny to rule all of America. They were the dominant race and therefore responsible for the Indians, along with their lands, their forests, and their mineral wealth. Only the New Englanders, who had destroyed or driven out all their Indians, spoke against manifest destiny. In 1850, although none of the Modocs, Mojaves, Paiutes, Shastas, Yumas, or 100 other lesser-known tribes along the Pacific coast were consulted on the matter, California became the 31st state of the Union. In the mountains of Colorado, gold was discovered, and new hordes of prospectors swarmed across the plains. Two vast new territories were organized, Kansas and Nebraska, encompassing virtually all the country of the plains tribes. In 1858, Minnesota became a state, its boundaries being extended 100 miles beyond the 95th meridian, the permanent Indian frontier. And so, only a quarter of a century after enactment of Sharp Knife Andrew Jackson's Indian Trade and Intercourse Act, white settlers had driven in both the north and south flanks of the 95th meridian line, and advance elements of white miners and traders had penetrated the center. It was then, at the beginning of the 1860s, that the white men of the United States went to war with one another, the blue coats against the gray coats, the Great Civil War. In 1860, there were probably 300,000 Indians in the United States and territories, most of them living west of the Mississippi. According to varying estimates, their numbers had been reduced by one-half to two-thirds since the arrival of the first settlers in Virginia and New England. The survivors were now pressed between expanding white populations on the east and along the Pacific coasts, more than 30 million Europeans and their descendants. If the remaining free tribes believed that the white man's civil war would bring any respite from his pressures for territory, they were soon disillusioned. The most numerous and powerful western tribe was the Sioux, or Dakota, which was separated into several subdivisions. The Santee Sioux lived in the woodlands of Minnesota, and for some years had been retreating before the advance of settlements. Little Crow of the Medukanaten Santee, after being taken on a tour of eastern cities, was convinced that the power of the United States could not be resisted. He was reluctantly attempting to lead his tribe down the white man's road. Wabashaw, another Santee leader, also had accepted the inevitable, but both he and Little Crow were determined to oppose any further surrender of their lands. Farther west on the Great Plains were the Teton Sioux, horse Indians all, and completely free. They were somewhat contemptuous of their woodland Santee cousins who had capitulated to the settlers. Most numerous and most confident of their ability to defend their territory were the Oglala Tetons. At the beginning of the white man's civil war, their outstanding leader was Red Cloud, 38 years old, a shrewd warrior chief. Still too young to be a warrior was Crazy Horse, an intelligent and fearless teenaged Oglala. Among the Hunkpapas, a smaller division of the Teton Sioux, a young man in his mid-twenties had already won a reputation as a hunter and warrior. In tribal councils, he advocated unyielding opposition to any intrusion by white men. He was Tatanka Yotanka, the Sitting Bull. He was mentor to an orphaned boy named Gall. Together with Crazy Horse of the Oglalas, they would make history 16 years later in 1876. Although he was not yet 40, Spotted Tail was already the chief spokesman for the Brule Tetons, who lived on the far western plains. Spotted Tail was a handsome, smiling Indian who loved fine feasts and compliant women. He enjoyed his way of life and the land he lived upon, but was willing to compromise to avoid war. Closely associated with the Teton Sioux were the Cheyennes. In the old days, the Cheyennes had lived in the Minnesota country of the Santee Sioux, but gradually moved westward and acquired horses. Now the northern Cheyennes shared the Powder River and the Bighorn country with the Sioux, frequently camping near them. Dull Knife, in his 40s, was an outstanding leader of the northern branch of the tribe. To his own people, Dull Knife was known as Morning Star, but the Sioux called him Dull Knife, and most contemporary accounts use that name. The southern Cheyennes had drifted below the Platte River, establishing villages on the Colorado and Kansas plains. Black Kettle of the southern branch had been a great warrior in his youth. In his late middle age, he was the acknowledged chief, but the younger men and the Hotametaneos, dog soldiers of the southern Cheyennes, were more inclined to follow leaders such as Tall Bull and Roman Nose, who were in their prime. The Arapahos were old associates of the Cheyennes and lived in the same areas. Some remained with the northern Cheyennes, others followed the southern branch. Little Raven, in his 40s, was at this time the best-known chief. South of the Kansas-Nebraska buffalo ranges were the Kiowas. Some of the older Kiowas could remember the Black Hills, but the tribe had been pushed southward before the combined power of Sioux, Cheyenne, and Arapaho. By 1860, the Kiowas had made their peace with the northern plains tribes and had become allies of the Comanches, whose southern plains they had entered. The Kiowas had several great leaders, an aging chief, Satank, two vigorous fighting men in their 30s, Satanta and Lone Wolf, and an intelligent statesman, Kicking Bird. The Comanches, constantly on the move and divided into many small bands, lacked the leadership of their allies. Ten Bears, very old, was more a poet than a warrior chief. In 1860, half-breed Quanah Parker, who would lead the Comanches in a last great struggle to save their buffalo range, was not yet 20 years old. In the arid southwest were the Apaches, veterans of 250 years of guerrilla warfare with the Spaniards, who taught them the finer arts of torture and mutilation, but never subdued them. Although few in number, probably not more than 6,000, divided into several bands, their reputation as tenacious defenders of their harsh and pitiless land was already well established. Mangus Colorado, in his late 60s, had signed a treaty of friendship with the United States, but was already disillusioned by the influx of miners and soldiers into his territory. Cochise, his son-in-law, still believed he could get along with the white Americans. Victorio and Delche distrusted the white intruders and gave them a wide berth. Nanné, in his 50s, but tough as rawhide, considered the English-speaking white men no different from the Spanish-speaking Mexicans he had been fighting all his life. Geronimo, in his 20s, had not yet proved himself. The Navajos were related to the Apaches, but most Navajos had taken the Spanish white man's road and were raising sheep and goats, cultivating grain and fruit. As stockmen and weavers, some bands of the tribe had grown wealthy. Other Navajos continued as nomads, raiding their old enemies the Pueblos, the white settlers, or prosperous members of their own tribe. Manuelito, a stalwart mustachioed stock raiser, was head chief, chosen by an election of the Navajos held in 1855. In 1859, when a few wild Navajos raided United States citizens in their territory, the U.S. Army retaliated not by hunting down the culprits, but by destroying the hogans and shooting all the livestock belonging to Manuelito and members of his band. By 1860, Manuelito and some Navajo followers were engaged in an undeclared war with the United States in northern New Mexico and Arizona. In the Rockies, north of the Apache and Navajo country, were the Utes, an aggressive mountain tribe inclined to raid their more peaceful neighbors to the south. Ouray, their best-known leader, favored peace with white men even to the point of soldiering with them as mercenaries against other Indian tribes. In the far west, most of the tribes were too small, too divided, or too weak to offer much resistance. The Modocs of northern California and southern Oregon, numbering less than 1,000, fought guerrilla fashion for their lands. Kintpuash, called Captain Jack by the California settlers, was only a young man in 1860. His ordeal as a leader would come a dozen years later. Northwest of the Modocs, the Nez Perces had been living in peace with white men since Lewis and Clark passed through their territory in 1805. In 1855, one branch of the tribe ceded Nez Perce lands to the United States for settlement and agreed to live within the confines of a large reservation. Other bands of the tribe continued to roam between the Blue Mountains of Oregon and the Bitter Roots of Idaho. Because of the vastness of the Northwest Country, the Nez Perces believed there would always be land enough for both white men and Indians to use as each saw fit. Inmot Tuyallaket, later known as Chief Joseph, would have to make a fateful decision in 1877 between peace and war. In 1860, he was 20 years old, the son of a chief. In the Nevada country of the Paiutes, a future messiah named Wovoka, who later would have a brief but powerful influence upon the Indians of the West, was only 4 years old in 1860. During the following 30 years, these leaders and many more would enter into history and legend. Their names would become as well known as those of the men who tried to destroy them. Most of them, young and old, would be driven into the ground long before the symbolic end of Indian freedom came at Wounded Knee in December 1890. Now, a century later, in an age without heroes, they are perhaps the most heroic of all Americans. Chapter 2. The Long Walk of the Navajos. 1860, March 12th, U.S. Congress passes Preemption Bill providing free land to settlers in Western Territories. April 3rd, First Pony Express leaves St. Joseph, Missouri, delivers letters at Sacramento, California, April 13th. April 23rd, Democratic National Convention at Charleston, South Carolina, divides on the slavery issue. May 16th to 18th, Republican National Convention in Chicago nominates Abraham Lincoln for president. June, population of U.S. reaches 31,443,321. July, Spencer repeating rifle invented. November 6th, Abraham Lincoln receives only 40% of popular vote but wins presidency. December 20th, South Carolina secedes from the Union. 1861, February 4th, Confederate Congress organized at Montgomery, Alabama. February 9th, Jefferson Davis elected President of Confederate States. February 11th, Abraham Lincoln says farewell to friends and neighbors at Springfield, Illinois, and leaves by train for Washington. March, President Davis asks for 100,000 soldiers to defend the Confederacy. April 12th, Confederates open fire on Fort Sumter. April 14th, Fort Sumter falls. April 15th, President calls for 75,000 volunteer soldiers. July 21st, First Battle of Bull Run. Union Army falls back on Washington. October 6th, rioting Russian students close down University of St. Petersburg. October 25th, Pacific Telegraph Line between St. Louis and San Francisco completed. December 5th, Gatling gun is patented. December 14th, British mourn death of Albert, Prince Consort of Queen Victoria. December 30th, U.S. banks suspend gold payments. When our fathers lived, they heard that the Americans were coming across the great river westward. We heard of guns and powder and lead, first flintlocks, then percussion caps, and now repeating rifles. We first saw the Americans at Cottonwood Wash. We had wars with the Mexicans and the Pueblos. We captured mules from the Mexicans and had many mules. The Americans came to trade with us. When the Americans first came, we had a big dance, and they danced with our women. We also traded. Manuelito of the Navajos. Manuelito and other Navajo leaders made treaties with the Americans. Then the soldiers built the fort here, Manuelito remembered, and gave us an agent who advised us to behave well. He told us to live peaceably with the whites, to keep our promises. They wrote down the promises so that we would always remember them. Manuelito tried to keep the promises in the treaty, but after the soldiers came and burned his hogans and killed his livestock because of something a few wild young Navajos had done, he grew angry at the Americans. He and his band had been wealthy, but the soldiers had made them poor. To become ricos again, they must raid the Mexicans to the south, and for this the Mexicans called them ladrones, or thieves. For as long as anyone could remember, the Mexicans had been raiding Navajos to steal their young children and make slaves of them. And for as long as anyone could remember, the Navajos had been retaliating with raids against the Mexicans. After the Americans came to Santa Fe and called the country New Mexico, They protected the Mexicans because they had become American citizens. The Navajos were not citizens because they were Indians. And when they raided the Mexicans, soldiers would come rushing into the Navajo country to punish them as outlaws. This was all an angry puzzle to Manuelito and his people, for they knew that many of the Mexicans had Indian blood, and yet no soldiers ever went rushing after the Mexicans to punish them for stealing Navajo children. The first fort the Americans built in the Navajo country was in a grassy valley at the mouth of Canyon Bonito. They called it Fort Defiance, and put their horses out to graze on pasture land long prized by Manuelito and his people. The soldier chief told the Navajos that the pastures belonged to the fort, and ordered them to keep their animals away. Because there was no fencing, the Navajos could not prevent their livestock from straying to the forbidden meadows. One morning, a company of mounted soldiers rode out of the fort and shot all the animals belonging to the Navajos. To replace their horses and mules, the Navajos raided the soldiers' herds and supply trains. The soldiers, in turn, began attacking bands of Navajos. In February 1860, Manuelito led 500 warriors against the army's horse herd, which was grazing a few miles north of Fort Defiance. The Navajo lances and arrows were no match for the well-armed soldier guard. They suffered more than 30 casualties, but captured only a few horses. During the following weeks, Manuelito and his ally Barboncito built up a force of more than 1,000 warriors. And in the darkness of the early hours of April 30th, they surrounded Fort Defiance. 2 hours before dawn, the Navajos attacked the fort from three sides. They were determined to wipe it off the face of their land. They came very near succeeding. With a rattle of fire from their few old Spanish guns, the Navajos drove in the sentries and overran several buildings. As startled soldiers poured from their barracks, they met showers of arrows, but after several minutes of confusion, the soldiers formed files and soon commenced a steady musket fire. When daylight came, the Navajos pulled back into the hills, satisfied that they had taught the soldiers a good lesson. The United States Army, however, considered the attack a challenge of the flag flying over Fort Defiance, an act of war. A few weeks later, Colonel Edward Richard Sprigg Canby, at the head of 6 companies of cavalry and 9 of infantry, was scouring the Chaska Mountains in search of Manuelito's hostiles. The troops marched through the Red Rock country until they wore out their horses and almost died of thirst. Although they seldom saw any Navajos, the Indians were there, harassing the column's flanks but making no direct attacks. By the end of the year, both sides grew weary of the foolish game. The soldiers were unable to punish the Navajos, and the Navajos were unable to attend to their crops and livestock. In January 1861, Manuelito, Barboncito, Herrero Grande, Armijo, Delgadito, and other Rico leaders agreed to meet Colonel Canby at a new fort the soldiers were building 35 miles southeast of Fort Defiance. The new fort was called Fort Fauntleroy, in honor of a soldier chief. At the end of the parleys with Canby, the Navajos chose Herrero Grande as head chief, February 21, 1861. The leaders agreed that it was best to live in peace, and Herrero Grande promised to drive all ladrones from the tribe. Manuelito was not sure that this promise could be carried out, but he signed his name to Canby's paper. A prosperous stock-raiser again, he believed in the virtues of peace and honesty. After the winter meeting at Fort Fauntleroy, there were several months of friendship between the soldiers and the Navajos. Rumors reached the Indians of a big war somewhere far to the east, a war between the white Americans of the north and south. They learned that some of Canby's soldiers had exchanged their blue coats for gray coats and gone east to fight against the blue coat soldiers there. One of them was the Eagle Chief, Colonel Thomas Fauntleroy. His name was blotted out, and now they called the post Fort Wingate. In this time of friendship, the Navajos went often to Fort Fauntleroy, Wingate, to trade and draw rations from their agent. Most of the soldiers made them welcome, and a custom grew up of having horse races between the Navajos and the soldiers. All the Navajos looked forward to these contests, and on racing days hundreds of men, women, and children would dress in their brightest costumes and ride their finest ponies to Fort Wingate. On a crisp, sunny morning in September, several races were run, but the special race of the day was scheduled at noon. It was to be between Pistol Bullet, a name given Manuelito by the soldiers, on a Navajo pony, and a lieutenant on a quarter horse. Many bets were made on this race, money, blankets, livestock, beads, whatever a man had to use for a bet. The horses jumped off together, but in a few seconds everyone could see that Pistol Bullet, Manuelito was in trouble. He lost control of his pony and it ran off the track. Soon everyone knew that Pistol Bullet's bridle rein had been slashed with a knife. The Navajos went to the judges, who were all soldiers, and demanded that the race be run again. The judges refused. They declared the lieutenant's quarter horse was the winner. Immediately, the soldiers formed a victory parade for a march into the fort to collect their bets. Infuriated by this trickery, the Navajos stormed after them, but the fort's gates were slammed shut in their faces. When a Navajo attempted to force an entrance, a sentinel shot him dead. What happened next was written down by a white soldier chief, Captain Nicholas Hott. The Navajos' squaws and children ran in all directions and were shot and bayoneted. I succeeded in forming about 20 men. I then marched out to the east side of the post. There I saw a soldier murdering 2 little children and a woman. I hallooed immediately to the soldier to stop. He looked up but did not obey my order. I ran up as quick as I could, but could not get there soon enough to prevent him from killing the 2 innocent children and wounding severely the squaw. I ordered his belts to be taken off and taken prisoner to the post. Meanwhile, the colonel had given orders to the officer of the day to have the artillery, mountain howitzers, brought out to open upon the Indians. The sergeant in charge of the mountain howitzers pretended not to understand the order given, for he considered it as an unlawful order. But being cursed by the officer of the day and threatened, he had to execute the order or else get himself in trouble. The Indians scattered all over the valley below the post, attacked the post herd, wounded the Mexican herder, but did not succeed in getting any stock. Also attacked the express man some 10 miles from the post, took his horse and mailbag and wounded him in the arm. After the massacre, there were no more Indians to be seen about the post, with the exception of a few squaws, favorites of the officers. The commanding officer endeavored to make peace again with the Navajos by sending some of the favorite squaws to talk with the chiefs. But the only satisfaction the squaws received was a good flogging. After that day, September 22, 1861, it was a long time before there was friendship again between white men and Navajos. Meanwhile, an army of Confederate Greycoats had marched into New Mexico and fought big battles with the Bluecoats along the Rio Grande. Kit Carson, the rope thrower, was a leader of the Bluecoats. Most of the Navajos trusted rope thrower Carson, because he had always talked one way to the Indians, and they hoped to make peace with him when he was finished with the Greycoats. In the spring of 1862, however, many more Bluecoats came marching into New Mexico from the west. They called themselves the California Column. Their general, James Carleton, wore stars on his shoulders and was more powerful than the Eagle Chief, Carson. These Californians camped along the Rio Grande Valley, but they had nothing to do because the Greycoats had all fled into Texas. The Navajos soon learned that Star Chief Carleton had a great hunger for their land and whatever metal wealth might be hidden under it. A princely realm, he called it, a magnificent pastoral and mineral country. As he had many soldiers with nothing to do but march around their parade grounds rattling their guns, Carleton began looking about for Indians to fight. The Navajos, he said, were wolves that run through the mountains and must be subdued. Carleton turned his attention first to the Mescalero Apaches, who numbered less than 1,000 and lived in scattered bands between the Rio Grande and the Pecos. His plan was to kill or capture all Mescaleros and then confine the survivors on a worthless reservation along the Pecos. This would leave the rich Rio Grande Valley open for land claims and settlement by American citizens. In September 1862, he sent out an order. There is to be no council held with the Indians, nor any talks. The men are to be slain whenever and wherever they can be found. The women and children may be taken as prisoners, but of course they are not to be killed. This was not Kit Carson's way of dealing with Indians, many of whom he counted as friends from his trading days. He sent his soldiers into the mountains, but he also opened up lines of communication with the Mescalero leaders. By late autumn, he had arranged for 5 chiefs to visit Santa Fe and negotiate with General Carleton. While en route to Santa Fe, 2 of the chiefs and their escorts met a detachment of soldiers under command of a former saloon keeper, Captain James Paddy Graydon. Graydon pretended great friendship for the Mescaleros, giving them flour and beef for their long journey. A short time later, near Galena Springs, Graydon's scouting party came upon the Mescaleros again. What happened there is not clear, because no Mescalero survived the incident. A white soldier chief, Major Arthur Morrison, reported briefly The transaction was very strangely committed by Captain Graydon, and from what I can learn, he deceived these Indians, going right into their camp and giving them liquor, afterwards shot them down, they, of course, thinking him to come with friendly purposes, as he had given them flour, beef, and provisions. The other three chiefs, Cadet, Chato, and Estrella, reached Santa Fe and assured General Carleton that their people were at peace with the white men and wanted only to be left alone in their mountains. "You are stronger than we," Cadet said. "We have fought you so long as we had rifles and powder, but your arms are better than ours. Give us like weapons and turn us loose. We will fight you again. But we are worn out. We have no more heart. We have no provisions, no means to live. Your troops are everywhere. Our springs and water holes are either occupied or overlooked by your young men. You have driven us from our last and best stronghold, and we have no more heart. Do with us as may seem good to you, but do not forget we are men and braves." Carleton haughtily informed them that the only way the Mescaleros could achieve peace would be to leave their country and go to the Bosque Redondo, the reservation he had prepared for them on the Pecos. There they would be kept in confinement by soldiers at a new military post called Fort Sumner. Outnumbered by the soldiers, unable to protect their women and children, and trusting in the goodwill of rope-thrower Carson, the Mescalero chiefs submitted to Carleton's demands and took their people into imprisonment at Bosque Redondo. With some uneasiness, the Navajos had been watching Carleton's quick and ruthless conquest of their cousins, the Mescalero Apaches. In December, 18 of the Rico leaders, including Delgadito and Barboncito, but not Manuelito, traveled to Santa Fe to see the general. They told him they represented peaceful Navajo herdsmen and farmers who wanted no war. This was the first time they had looked upon Star Chief Carleton. His face was hairy, his eyes were fierce, and his mouth was that of a man without humor. He did not smile when he told Delgadito and the others, "You can have no peace until you give other guarantees than your word that the peace should be kept. Go home and tell your people so. I have no faith in your promises." By the spring of 1863, most of the Mescaleros had either fled to Mexico or been herded into the Bosque Redondo. In April, Carleton went to Fort Wingate to gather information for a campaign against the Navajos as soon as the grass starts sufficiently to support stock. He arranged a meeting with Delgadito and Barboncito near Cubero, and bluntly informed the chiefs that the only way they could prove their peaceful intentions would be to take their people out of the Navajo country and join the contented Mescaleros at Bosque Redondo. To this, Barboncito replied, "I will not go to the Bosque. I will never leave my country, not even if it means that I will be killed." On June 23rd, Carleton set a deadline for Navajo removal to the Bosque Redondo. "Send for Delgadito and Barboncito again," he instructed the commanding officer at Fort Wingate, "and repeat what I before told them, and tell them that I shall feel very sorry if they refuse to come in. Tell them they can have until the 20th day of July of this year to come in. They, and all those who belong to what they call the Peace Party, that after that day, every Navajo that is seen will be considered as hostile and treated accordingly. That after that day, the door now open will be closed." The 20th of July came and went, but no Navajos volunteered to surrender. In the meantime, Carleton had ordered Kit Carson to march his troops from the Mescalero country to Fort Wingate and prepare for a war against the Navajos. Carson was reluctant. He complained that he had volunteered to fight Confederate soldiers, not Indians, and he sent Carleton a letter of resignation. Kit Carson liked Indians. In the old days, he had lived with them for months at a time without seeing another white man. He had fathered a child by an Arapaho woman and had lived for a time with a Cheyenne woman. But after he married Josefa, daughter of Don Francisco Jaramillo of Taos, Carson had taken new roads, grown prosperous, and claimed land for a ranch. He discovered that in New Mexico there was room at the top even for a rough, superstitious, illiterate mountain man. He learned to read and write a few words, and although he was only 5 feet 6 inches tall, his name touched the sky. Famous as he was, the rope-thrower never overcame his awe of the well-dressed, smooth-talking men at the top. In 1863, in New Mexico, the biggest man at the top was Star Chief Carleton. And so in the summer of that year, Kit Carson withdrew his resignation from the army and went to Fort Wingate to take the field against the Navajos. Before the campaign was over, his reports to Carleton were echoing the manifest destiny presumptions of the arrogant man from whom he took orders. The Navajos respected Carson as a fighter, but they had no use for his soldiers, the New Mexico Volunteers. Many of them were Mexicans, and the Navajos had been chasing them out of their country as long as anyone could remember. There were 10 times as many Navajos as Mescaleros, and they had the advantage of a vast and rugged country broken by deep canyons, steep-banked arroyos, and precipice-flanked mesas. Their stronghold was Canyon de Chelly, cutting westward for 30 miles from the Chuska Mountains. Narrowing in some places to 50 yards, the canyon's red rock walls rose 1,000 feet or more, with overhanging ledges offering excellent defensive positions against invaders. At points where the canyon widened to several 100 yards, the Navajos grazed sheep and goats on pasturage, or raised corn, wheat, fruit, and melons on cultivated soil. They were especially proud of their peach orchards, carefully tended since the days of the Spaniards. Water flowed plentifully through the canyon for most of the year, and there were enough cottonwood and box elder trees to supply wood for fuel. Even when they learned that Carson had marched 1,000 soldiers to Pueblo, Colorado, and had hired his old friends the Utes to serve as trackers, the Navajos were still scornful. The chiefs reminded their people of how in the old days they had driven the Spaniards from their land. "If the Americans come to take us, we will kill them," the chiefs promised, but they took precautions to secure the safety of their women and children. They knew the mercenary Utes would try to make captives of them for sale to wealthy Mexicans. Late in July, Carson moved up to Fort Defiance, renamed it for the Indians' old adversary, Canby, and began sending out reconnaissance detachments. He probably was not surprised that few Navajos could be found. He knew that the only way to conquer them was to destroy their crops and livestock, scorch their earth. And on July 25th, he sent Major Joseph Cummings to bring in all livestock that could be found and to harvest or burn all corn and wheat along the Bonito. As soon as the Navajos discovered what Cummings was doing to their winter food supply, he became a marked man. A short time later, a Navajo marksman shot him out of his saddle, killing him instantly. They also raided Carson's corral near Fort Canby, recaptured some sheep and goats, and stole the rope thrower's favorite horse. General Carleton was far more nettled by such incidents than Carson, who had lived with Indians long enough to appreciate bold retorts. On August 18th, the general decided to stimulate the zeal of his troops by posting prize money for captured Navajo livestock. He offered to pay $20 for every sound serviceable horse or mule, and $1 per head for sheep brought into the commissary at Fort Canby. As the soldiers' pay was less than $20 per month, the bounty offered did stimulate them, and some of the men extended it to the few Navajos they were able to kill. To prove their soldierly abilities, they began cutting off the knot of hair fastened by a red string which the Navajos wore on their heads. The Navajos could not believe that Kit Carson condoned scalping, which they considered a barbaric custom introduced by the Spaniards. The Europeans may or may not have introduced scalping to the New World, but the Spanish, French, Dutch, and English colonists made the custom popular by offering bounties for scalps of their respective enemies. Although Carson continued his steady destruction of grain fields, of bean and pumpkin patches, he was moving too slowly to suit General Carleton. In September, Carleton ordered that thenceforth every Navajo male was to be killed or taken prisoner on sight. He wrote out for Carson the exact words he was to use to captured Navajos. "Say to them, 'Go to the Bosque Redondo, or we will pursue and destroy you. We will not make peace with you on any other terms. This war shall be pursued against you if it takes years. Now that we have begun, until you cease to exist or move, there can be no other talk on the subject.'" About this same time, the general was writing War Department headquarters in Washington, demanding an additional regiment of cavalry. More soldiers were needed, he said, because of a new gold strike not far west of the Navajo country, troops sufficient to whip the Indians and to protect the people going to and at the mines. Providence has indeed blessed us. The gold lies here at our feet to be had by the mere picking of it up. Under Carleton's obsessive prodding, Kit Carson accelerated his scorched earth program, and by autumn had destroyed most of the herds and grain between Fort Canby and Canyon de Chelly. On October 17th, two Navajos appeared under a truce flag at Fort Wingate. One of them was El Sordo, emissary for his brothers Delgadito and Barboncito and their 500 followers. Their food supply was gone, El Sordo said. They were reduced to eating pinion nuts. They were almost naked of clothing and blankets and were too fearful